Welcome to the Safe Space ABA podcast. My name is Michelle Zeman and I am your host. Super excited to launch into space with you all tonight for this amazing episode on multiculturalism in applied behavior analysis. And be sure to hear for the two code words in tonight's podcast. I really want you guys to pay attention to these so that way you can get your free CEUs. So tonight I am super excited because I have the honor to introduce my guest for tonight's episode. Her name is Quintera Tucker. She is a board certified behavior analyst. She's an international behavior analyst and a licensed behavior specialist. She is also super well-versed and very experienced in writing behavior intervention plans for clients with multiculturalism, so she's a really great resource. I'm super excited to introduce her on tonight's podcast. So hi, Quintera.
Hi, Michelle. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. I'm super excited to have you. How are you doing tonight?
I am doing very well. Thank you so much for asking. I cannot complain.
Good. That is awesome. To give you guys an idea, the local time is 8:10 p.m. So
yes,
We've gotten through our day.
Yes, you know? We've had a day.
Yes, it's been a nice, today's Tuesday, February 13th. So, you know, it's been a nice and long Tuesday, working all day, you know, some breaks here and there, but for the most part, just working along, you know.
Indeed. So,
yeah. Oh my goodness. But let me tell you, I was really excited to do this episode in particular. Because, you know, we work with a lot of different types of clients that come from a lot of different backgrounds, that come from different socioeconomic statuses. And I feel like that as a BCBA, it's so important for our listeners who not only want to become BCBAs, but want to practice in a field with a variety of clients to really understand that, you know, there is so much that needs to be taken in. You know what I mean?
I do. There are actually so many, not only different diverse cultures, but there are so many cultural variables that we should consider as practitioners, you know, when working with our clients and their stakeholders and things like that.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's amazing because, you know, I've worked with a lot of different families in my career as a BCBA, but then again, you know, I've only worked with so many families as a BCBA, you know, like I only have worked with so many different people, and where, you know, where other people might have worked with other diverse populations that maybe I've never been exposed to, you know, and that's where for me as a BCBA, I'm truly wanting to ensure that I am not only being mindful, but I'm practicing compassionate care. You know, so my first question to you, Quintera, is yes. How do you integrate principles of compassionate care into the development and implementation of behavior intervention plans within multicultural contexts, especially when you're considering cultural variables such as age and SES and gender identity?
I think before we get into all of the, you know, the meat of our discussion here tonight, I think to first answer your question, I would like to share that I do go into a lot of homes, a lot of settings, extremely humble. Humble, I mean, I take the time out and I set aside, you know, my personal beliefs, and I tap in using that compassion with the clients that I'm, you know, that I'm working with. Once realizing that I was able to do this and that this is something that I should be doing, I was able to better integrate that culture of humility and that compassionate care while working with, you know, our clients and students. I'll refer to clients and students just because, you know, I work in a school setting primarily, so I often call them students. But in the home and in the community, right, we refer to those as clients.
Right. And absolutely. And I'm so glad you mentioned, you know, taking out the bias and bringing in the humility. And I'm really curious to know, because, you know, some of us come into what we do and we sort of like have our own set of beliefs. What does cultural humility mean to you? And how do you feel we should apply that as practitioners in our field?
Sure. This is actually one of my favorite questions to answer because I love disseminating this topic so much. Before we get into cultural humility, I think it would be a great idea for me to first define culture as the way you and I are going to discuss it tonight. Culture, in the terms that we will be discussing it tonight, just means anything that a group of individuals share, right? So there is a podcast culture, right? Maybe podcast hosts know all of the, you know, the great microphones and the great technical stuff. There is a BCBA culture. There's even like an RBT culture, right? There, it's very rare that I'll run into an RBT who does not know what I mean when I say 5%, right? Yeah. So that culture, you know, it's anything, again, that a group of people share. So yeah. Typically, right, when we are working with individuals, this term cultural competence came into fruition. It was mainly used in the psychological setting to denote or to signify an end goal, right? We want to be culturally competent enough to know everything about all of the cultures in which we are dealing with while working as psychologists or as clinicians, practitioners, etc. However, through much research recently in ABA, we have moved from that term cultural competence and moved towards the term cultural humility, simply because the term humility doesn't denote an end goal such as competence does, right? So cultural humility just kind of signifies or suggests that this is a lifelong process, right? That we are going to be exploring and self-reflecting and educating ourselves on all of the different cultures that we are working with or that are out there that we could possibly come into contact with. The term cultural humility doesn't necessarily mean that I have to know everything about your culture, Michelle, right? Because right. In fact, I probably never will. And the more we end up speaking and the more we connect outside of this podcast, the chances of me in unintentionally offending you are actually greater because yeah. We're interacting so much more. And I don't know so much about your culture as, you know, cultural competence suggests that I should know. However, if we're practicing cultural humility, right, I'm allowing myself that grace. I'm allowing myself the opportunity to self-reflect, to educate myself, and to identify and apologize if I've unintentionally offended you. Right. It gives us the space to communicate with one another and to discuss how that behavior, my behavior, that if I've unintentionally offended you, can be changed moving forward.
Wow. That was beautiful. That was beautiful. I mean, seriously, you know, it's so nice to hear, you know, it's so nice to hear this because, you know, I know that we strive so much on cultural competence. Yes. We need to assume competence, but really it should be about humility. Yep. You know, like we come from so many different backgrounds. We come from different, you know, spaces and whatnot. And so, you know, you're absolutely right. Like we have to be very careful, but at the same time, we have to give ourselves the grace of, you know, we might unintentionally offend one another. And I really appreciate you just bringing that to the forefront, you know?
Of course. And to be honest, right, I'm still learning about my own culture every day, right? So I'm practicing cultural humility within myself, you know? I'm self-reflecting and I am identifying my own stereotypes when it comes to working with diverse cultures because, you know, they're present. We've been exposed to these stereotypes and we have to make sure we're self-reflecting, we're acknowledging those stereotypes, and then we're then setting them aside in order to provide that compassionate and that multicultural care.
I love that. I love that so much. And, you know, I get really curious because there are some times where, you know, like people might unintentionally put their biases in there. Mm-hmm. Intentional or unintentional, but a lot of times I have seen unintentional, if I'm being perfectly honest here.
Yeah.
But that being said, you know, it is in our ethics code about, you know, making sure that we are, for in plain language, taking our biases out of our work, essentially. And so when it comes to that, like, how do you feel as mm-hmm. one should sort of separate their biases into the work? And do you think that there's a limitation of maybe I can't do this. Maybe I need to separate myself because I can't do this.
Yeah, 100%. I do believe, to answer the tail end of your question, that that is possible, right? We will, as you know, behavior analysts, work with clients that maybe we cannot separate the two. Maybe our religious beliefs are that they contradict one another so much that it's not a safe or healthy or even, you know, productive work environment to form that client or that therapeutic relationship. So yeah. I do think, you know, that is definitely possible. And I think that's when we refer to our ethics code again. And we really decide, you know, all right, is this appropriate for me? Am I doing more harm than good if I do take on this client, right? We have to consult our supervisors. We have to, you know, educate ourselves. We have to self-reflect. We have to engage and do the research. But at the end of the day, you also have to make that decision upon yourself to really identify whether or not you're a great suit for that client or that family.
And, you know, I will be honest with you, there have been times like in my own career where I've even questioned, like, am I the best fit for this family? And even like, you know, I think some of us get caught up in, oh, well, I wasn't the best fit after all. And you mentioned about self-reflection. Mm-hmm. You mentioned something about, you know, like you do have to take time to reflect. You do have to take time to really kind of see the variables. What are some strategies that maybe a BCBA can reflect on those variables so that way maybe they're not making the same mistake again, but maybe they might approach a client or approach a situation differently?
So something that I do often during self-reflection is I write it out. Any, you know, session that I had that maybe didn't go as I planned, or maybe an interaction with a client or their family didn't go as planned, or any interaction with staff members at the school, right? I write down, or in today's world, let's be honest, I type it out and then I reread it and I highlight, you know, what could have been said differently, what could have been done differently, where was my mistake? I think the bigger thing really is that accountability. We, as behavior analysts, we have to be easy on ourselves, but we also have to take accountability, right? Because we of all people know how behavior change works. And there is nothing in any ethics code or in the Cooper book that says we cannot change our own behavior, right? We work so hard at modifying and changing others' behaviors that we so often do not realize that this is a full-time job for us as well. We have to, you know, modify and change our own behaviors to make sure that we are, you know, that competent, you know, practitioner.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you nailed it right on the head. You know, I feel like you absolutely hit the nail on the head when it comes to that, because, you know, and accountability is so important in our field, and really it's important in life, but yes. I feel like in our field, when we are working with humans, it's really, really important. And, you know, that being said, you know, I get very curious to know a little bit about like navigating those cultural differences, right? I know that we talked a little bit about like, you know, taking cultural humility. Sorry, I'm saying cultural humidity today.
No, that's okay. It's definitely a mouthful.
Yes, it is. It is. You know, so I get really curious about like, you know, when it comes to cultural differences, how do you navigate those cultural differences and attitudes towards behavioral interventions, especially like when you're working with parents and school personnel, when you may have varying cultural perspectives on what you may feel is reinforcement and punishment?
Yeah, of course. Sure. So collaboration, true and genuine collaboration, is how I navigate those cultural differences, because I know and understand that everyone is different. I know and understand that everyone may raise their children differently. Teachers may provide instruction differently. So being, again, culturally humble enough to sit down with stakeholders, to sit down with myself, and to discuss a plan or a solution that is coupled with that compassion and then that humility, but still stands on those behavior analytic principles, is what's most important.
Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned the word collaboration. Mm-hmm. I feel like that word is tossed around a lot, but also not done enough, you know? Yep. And I say this with a pure heart here, but you know, there are times where it's like, we look at doing collaboration and coordination of care and it's like, okay, we have to do it because, you know, it's part of our intervention plan.
Yeah.
But how do we know that we're truly collaborating? How do we know that we're truly, you know, coordinating care? Because, you know, in some cases it sort of feels like, you know, oh, we're just doing it to check off a box. But how do we know, how do we know that we have the buy-in, you know?
Yeah. So I am a very firm believer of reading my own energy. I believe my body is going to tell me what's up before I even know what's up, right? So just to get a little personal, if my stomach hurts going to a session, if my stomach hurts going into work, if I'm feeling uneasy, something's not right. And it's typically that collaboration piece that's missing. Now, I'm not sure if, you know, depending on the situation, right? It could be me. It could be me being that behavior analyst who is also a PhD student who also is heavy in the literature, right? It could be me just coming in and saying, this is what we're going to do, because this is what the literature says, and not taking that time to hear the other party. It could also be that the other party just doesn't respect me because of my cultural differences, right? My age, my, you know, my gender, my race or ethnicity, whatever it could be, right? So to answer your question, you'll definitely know if collaboration is not happening because there's no behavior change happening in your clients.
And that's a really good point too, because when you think about it, like I'm thinking about it from a buy-in perspective too, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't have buy-in from your parties and your consumers, you're not going to get the progress that you want, you know? And that being said too, I mean, have you ever navigated a situation where maybe, you know, maybe something just wasn't right? Maybe, you know, maybe this was not the right situation and this wasn't the right fit and you almost had to walk away. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about an experience like that, if you have one.
I'm sure that I've had one, especially earlier on. I mean, I've been a BCBA for a little over 2 years now, but I've been in the field for a really long time. So I think I've had more of these experiences, believe it or not, as an RBT. I don't think I had an issue with obtaining buy-in, right? I am a very happy person. I wish they could see me smiling this entire time. My cheeks are going to hurt after this podcast, because I'm just always smiling and I'm so happy. But sometimes that's not enough for people. So one particular experience, I was removed from a case simply as an RBT because the family didn't want someone Black in their home. That was the first time that I felt like I've experienced something regarding my race. It was the first time I've experienced something, like that in general, because again, it's me, I'm Quintara. Why wouldn't you want me in your home? But unfortunately people have their beliefs, right? And unfortunately, no matter what I was doing wonderful ABA at this time. And I've held an extreme grudge with this family for years, simply because I was still showing up to these cases and my grandfather had just passed and I was still doing what the ethics code was telling me to do and things like that. So I was very careful with how I maneuvered this case, right? So to find out that I was, you know, asked to be removed because of this, it really, that's when my viewpoint with buy-in, collaboration, and my perspective of ABA has changed. And I think this is why my passion stands with multiculturalism in ABA, because I've been there, you know?
Yeah. Wow. You know, first of all, I'm so sorry that happened to you. I want to make that very clear.
Yeah.
It's never easy being removed from a case. I've been removed from a case, personally speaking, because I was a little bit more transparent than usual with the family. And also because I was too young. So I can't say I've been quite there.
Yeah.
been removed before, and it's awful. It's an awful feeling, you know. Yeah. And you mentioned holding a grudge. I mean, I get it. I definitely held a grudge with the family that I got removed from, you know. But at the end of the day, too, like, you know, it's amazing because you took that experience and made it your passion about, you know, making sure that when it comes to buy-in and multiculturalism, that we're being very humble and that we're looking at things from a compassionate point of view, as opposed to, well, you know, this family just didn't like me. And so, you know what I mean?
I do. I took that time to self-reflect. And once I've gotten over blaming myself for it, I was able to see things just a little bit differently. And again, like you said, I turned it into my passion. That way I can hopefully share these experiences with, you know, those who are up and coming in the field. That way they know how to navigate something similar. Because if we're being honest, this is going to continue to happen to, you know, everyone is going to have a very similar experience, whether it's, you know, again, race, age, sexual orientation, right? Someone is going to have this experience. And I think it's really important that we talk about it so much more and we learn how to navigate it together as a field.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we come from very different backgrounds. Like, I am a white cisgender female. I'm autistic. And so I have my own set of cultural beliefs and values. But at the same time, too, it's so important that we interact, collaborate, and see kind of like how we can, you know, integrate our cultures in a way that in which that we are being, you know, not only culturally humble, but at the same time, we are being very open and collaborative and compassionate, you know, because like I said, you know, we work with a variety of families. We don't know what a family's experience is like.
Yeah.
You know,
I agree. And you definitely displayed some compassion even to me just now, right? I think a lot of people confuse empathy and compassion, right? Empathy is putting yourself in someone else's shoes, right? Feeling what they're feeling. But compassion, it takes that extra step. Right. I'm going to be compassionate towards you, I'm going to not only put myself into your shoes, hear you, understand you, but I'm also going to then share something similar that has happened to me. That way I can also feel, okay, well, maybe, you know, it's not just me. Maybe this is also a bigger problem that we also have to, you know, continue to address. So I definitely appreciate that. And that lovely demonstration of compassion, which you unintentionally displayed.
I appreciate that so much. I really do. And thank you. Thank you for that.
Of course. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, and something that I think about too is the role of not only cultural competence, but cultural humility. Yes. Tell me a little bit about that role in promoting compassionate care within the context of behavior analysis and intervention, especially when you're working with diverse families and diverse school communities as well. Tell me a little bit about that.
Of course. So kind of backtracking to what we discussed already, right? That true difference between cultural competence and cultural humility. I think a lot of people are turned off by the term cultural humility because it requires us to do some work, right? Yeah. Cultural competence, it's more like, okay, you've read your article. Mm-hmm. Check. Right. Whereas cultural humility is it's a lifestyle. It's something that you have to commit to, and it's something you have to engage in every single day. And I feel like a lot of people are turned off by that because, again, as behavior analysts, we love permanent products. But with cultural humility, there aren't any. You're continuously doing this work, and you're continuously literally looking yourself in the mirror and, you know, taking out your own biases, your own stereotypes, and your own flaws.
Yeah.
So when you utilizing cultural humility, you know, in practice, right? I definitely think that doing so, you know, through programming, doing so through staff training, and things like that is extremely important because that's where that role of that cultural humility is really going to show its face.
Absolutely. I mean, And again, like, I feel like you nailed it on the head when it comes to, you know, making sure that that it's being, you know, practiced every single day. You know, we as behavior analysts are expected to grow every single day. We're never going to be the greatest thing that's ever happened since sliced bread. You know, just because we got our 3, 4, 5 letters after our name doesn't mean we are better than anybody else, you know?
No, unfortunately, though, some people think that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I love it. But that being said, too, you know, oh my goodness. Yeah. You know, I could go on about that. But that being said, you know, I'm really glad that you talk about culture humility being an everyday practice. You know, self-reflection being something that should be practiced every single day. And, you know, you yourself are a BCBA and you yourself have the opportunity to work with a variety of people. You know, have you ever encountered a situation where you've had to give feedback on, you know, making sure that they are being, you know, they are showing cultural humility to their clients or their students?
Yes, actually, all the time. Again, like you said, one of the biggest roles of being a BCBA is definitely the supervision piece, right? So I supervise a handful of RBTs, probably 2 hands worth of RBTs, right? So I'm always providing feedback. I'm always there. I'm always present in the moment. And again, not that anyone is wrong, because if you don't know, you'll never know, right?
Right.
Until someone provides you with that feedback. So there are definitely situations or instances when, you know, my staff have to be reminded that it's okay. I think, you know, the student is just tired. It's okay. I think the student is actually just hungry. Did they functionally request a snack? They can eat, right? So I think using things, again, that compassionate piece, and then tying that into the cultural humility piece and just understanding different cultural variables that could impact behavior, right? You mentioned earlier, you know, socioeconomic status, right? You know, I've had a few clients or a few students who were from lower SES levels, right?
Yeah.
So breakfast and school lunch and things like that, meals were just hard to come by. So when a student is coming into school every day and they're moody, or, you know, and the teacher or the staff are looking like, oh goodness, like, you know, what's their problem today? Well, they're probably hungry. They live in a multi-generational household. They probably don't sleep in a bed of their own. They're probably co-sleeping with other adults or other children, right? So understanding that allows me to provide that compassionate feedback. And then when I do, everyone's like, oh, yeah, you know, like, I didn't really even think of that. And I'm like, it's okay. You know, but sometimes I think we do have to consider variables like that, because it does impact, you know, an individual's behavior.
You know, and it's great that you say that, because we as behavior analysts are so stuck on the 4 functions of behavior.
Yes. You know? Yes.
Yeah. And that's all fine and dandy, but like, how do you know that the 4 functions of behavior are truly what they are when you're not considering all those other variables as well? You mentioned, you know, multi-generation households, you know, and I've personally had several clients who have lived in multi-generation households. And so for me, I'm sitting here and I'm like, you know, oh my, like I've never been in that situation. I've never had like, I've never been there. So I cannot relate. But I can only imagine how they must be feeling, how, you know, because it's one thing to look at it as, oh, well, you know, for example, I'm going to throw a tantrum out there. Tantruming because he wants access to the iPad.
Yep.
But, you know, when you think about it, like there are other considerations that we have to take into account, you know?
No, I completely, 100% and wholeheartedly agree, right? You know, I have a client currently who is extremely attached to, you know, one of my staff members. I love to see it, because I'm so glad that, you know, the kiddos love, you know, my staff. Like, that's something you always want to see, right? But everyone, I feel like, was at first looking at it as a behavior, and they wanted to change that behavior as opposed to looking deeper into, well, what could be going on that he's so completely attached to a woman figure while at school, right? you know, it turns out that, you know, he too lives in a multi-generational household, and, you know, grandma had left, right? Went on a trip, like went back to, you know, their home country. So, you know, he's missing someone. He literally, there is a piece missing in this child's life. And it's easier to program again for, you know, that behavior change when you understand things like that, because you could approach it so much with so much more compassion.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to dive right into that. But first, I want to give out the first code word. Our first code word of tonight's podcast is humility. That's been the name of the game all podcast. Humility. Yes. Humility. So that's H-U-M-I-L-I-T-Y. That is humility. I'm so glad that you brought that specific example up, because some of my experience, not as a BCBA, but actually as a direct support professional, that was like my first exposure to working in the field. I worked with teenage clients who would get attached to staff members as well, but come to find out they were abandoned when, yep, you know, they were younger, or, you know, they had mothers who were in, and they have their own set of issues, unfortunately, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. You know, they were in abusive relationships and they would seek out male attention. And so they would ultimately like script the violence that they like saw, and then also find themselves attached if there was a person who looked like that figure for them, you know? And so it just goes to show you don't know what happens behind closed doors.
No, right? And then you don't know really at all. And I love the four functions of behavior, but I definitely think, you know, there's a little more to them, right? So yeah, in your example and in my example, right, the function is access to attention, access to someone, right? So, right. However, why, right? Yeah. I think there's an additional why that sometimes we have to ask or consider, you know, when working with our clients and students.
Yeah, and it's so true, which makes me want to go into another question. You know, what strategies do you employ to foster trust and collaboration within school personnel, and not only school personnel, but, you know, your RBTs and who you work with from diverse cultural backgrounds, while implementing behavior plans with a compassionate care approach?
So I definitely use behavior skills training a lot, right? But when I'm making sure I'm using when I'm providing that informational piece, and I'm using the model piece, right, that I'm including and I'm incorporating, that cultural humility should be a part of, you know, of this practice. Because unfortunately, it's not really discussed in our master's level programs. It's only, I think, in one or two ethics codes, right? So it's nothing that is really openly discussed unless you've experienced something. And then people then often throw out the, you know, the term cultural competence, and you should know better, you should read this and read that. But that, again, that self-reflection piece is definitely something that we, you know, we kind of skip over.
And it's amazing, because you're right. I mean, yeah. I graduated from grad school in 2014. So it's been over 10 years now.
Yeah.
From the time. And I can tell you right now, like, yeah, I took an ethics course.
Yeah.
Didn't learn about cultural humility in grad school. Mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm. You know, did I really even learn about what it was as I started as a BT, as even as a BCBA when I first started? I mean, I probably knew about it, but I didn't put a name to it, and I didn't put a practice to it, because I didn't realize it either.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so it just kind of goes to show you that, you know, you always have so much more to learn. There's always so much more to, you never stop growing. And also, too, it just goes to show you, like, put yourself in their shoes. Like, you can't even imagine how your clients are feeling and what they're going through.
Yep.
You know?
I agree.
Oh, man. This has been such a great conversation.
So I know. We could get so much more, like, we could go on forever about
I feel this. Like I really do feel like it. But I feel like this conversation is so important because it's not talked enough, you know? Like you and I have both said, you know, this conversation is, I hate to say this the way I'm about to say it, practically non-existent.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
No, I think you are correct. I think it's a lot more, it's definitely a lot more, you know, talked about now, especially through research. So, but that target audience, again, are PhD students. That target audience, again, are individuals who attend conferences.
Yeah.
That target audience are individuals who can afford to attend conferences. Right. So I think ABA still has so much more work to do when it comes to implementing cultural humility, not only in our practice as practitioners, but in our field in general, such as incorporating it into coursework, incorporating it into fieldwork supervision, ensuring that it's incorporated outside of the clinical world. Right. I am so, so happy to see that conferences now are offering, you know, like student rate discounts or scholarship opportunities where we can donate, you know, tickets to, you know, for, you know, certain individuals who meet certain criteria. I am so happy to see that conferences now are offering childcare. Right. So these are things we're moving. We're definitely moving in the right direction. But like you said, I'm not sure that people know that I'm not sure they know what cultural humility is, and that's what it is we're moving toward.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really great because it's great that this conversation is being had, you know, because it does help us. Like, it helps me at the very least, you know, kind of understand how I can approach my own practice. And how I interact with my clients versus anything else, you know?
Yep.
And it also helps too from a supervisor standpoint too, because I mean, for me, like I do supervise some RBTs that want to become BCBA someday.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, like I want to make sure that they are not only learning about, you know, like how to work on specific things with clients, but also how can they model the behavior that we want our field to grow into, you know? Yeah. So it's so amazing too. Like even the other, I want to say it was like a few weeks ago, I had someone come up to me and be like, Michelle, I've not heard about people, for example, withdrawing demands when somebody tells us no, because we're so gung-ho on follow through with the demand in place.
Yes.
And, you know, it's like, why?
Well, I have a motto with my staff. All you have to do is tell me no one time. That like we teach, you know, you know, especially in school, right? We teach self-advocacy so much. But when a child is displaying their mastery of that behavior, we're still following through with demands. We're still getting into power struggles. No, you said no. Cool. You don't have to. You don't owe me an explanation. I'll come back. We'll try again. We'll modify it in some way, right? It doesn't necessarily mean they're escaping the demand. If they're saying no, maybe they just don't want to do it in that room. Maybe they just don't want to do it using that writing utensil. Maybe they don't like the color of the paper. I'll figure it out. All you have to do is tell me no one time. Again, maybe they're hungry, going back to that, right? If a child is telling me no, I'm looking at the clock first and I'm looking at the immediate environment. What is in here that would make this child feel uncomfortable to the point where they feel like they have to advocate for themselves, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it just makes it that much, it's that much more important, you know, that contributes to cultural humility, at least in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, realizing that you are not above it all, because it's easy to say, like, I have the three, four, five letters after my name. I know everything. But the truth is you don't, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, they are the expert on themselves. They have the right, they should have the right to be able to understand that. And, correct. You know, maybe this is just me, but perhaps, like, cultural humility can be, you know, taking yourself out of yourself as, like, a behavior analyst and trying to be more understanding, maybe not relating, but seeking to understand your environment, seeking to understand why things the way they are, and seeking to understand, you know, their life. Because at the end of the day, it's about them. It's not about you. Am I right on that?
Yeah, no, I think you're onto something, right? Because when we couple that, your explanation or your definition with compassion, we get self-reflection, right? Because that compassion is going back to our example of the student who told us no, right? Compassion and cultural humility is taking, again, a step outside of myself and looking around. Would I want to do this work in this current environment, right? Mm-hmm. That's compassion. That's understanding that maybe that chair is uncomfortable. Maybe these lights are too bright, because if I don't want to be in here, how can I ask a 5-6-year-old student to be in here and complete, you know, high work demands, you know, as well, right? Am I hungry? Did I eat today? Do I have to use the bathroom? Because we have to understand a lot of clients aren't at that, you know, that level where they can advocate for themselves and all they can say is no.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm so, like, happy that, again, like, I have said this already. I'm so happy this conversation is happening. Like, it just makes me that much happier to even, like, have this discussion. And I'm really excited for our listeners to really, like, understand and self-reflect and, you know, sort of, like, look at how they practice behavior analysis, assuming that our listeners do practice behavior analysis or just practice, you know, being a human in everyday life, you
correct.
Know,
correct.
You know, because cultural humility doesn't have to just happen in ABA. It can happen everywhere.
Yep. That's where it starts everywhere else. Right. We're just lucky that we have ABA to guide us because, again, we know how behavior change works. So you take data on your practice of cultural humility. Right. Who knows where you could be a year from now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I feel like I was a different person last night, let alone, you know, this conversation. So only imagine your growth from, you know, now and next year, you know, just, it's amazing. It's amazing what you learn. So one thing that I get really curious about too, is how do you ensure that the behavior intervention plans that you write for your clients and for your students are culturally responsive and sensitive to the unique needs and values of families and school personnel while still maintaining effectiveness in addressing those behavior challenges?
Yeah, sure. So pretty much when creating culturally responsive plans, behavior plans in particular, right, one also must consider the environment in which the plan is intended for implementation. Because not only are you creating a culturally responsive behavior plan for the client, but you also are creating a culturally responsive intervention plan for the individuals implementing that plan, right? So, for example, in a school setting, you might be able to email the behavior plan that you've written to teachers, to staff, you know, to case managers, et cetera. However, if you're working at home or you're working in the community with, you know, with a family whose parents, you know, may be older, maybe they prefer a hard copy, right? So you want to consider cultural variables, again, such as age and, you know, generation, right? Because things are different. Things are changing every second, right? You know, something as simple as, again, sending an email or printing out a hard copy can make or break your buy-in when attempting to implement behavior intervention plans. So you have to make sure you tailor them not only to the individual, but to the environment in which it's intended for.
That's amazing. I mean, it's so true though, too, because when you think about it, you know, some environments may call for, you know, certain, like you know, your behavior intervention plan might just be something that is written somewhere in like a binder in your desk, or maybe you have like an email copy, or maybe you have like, you know, just some sort of like written communication, or maybe you just, I don't know, maybe you just kind of like have it in your head, I guess, yeah, for lack of a better term. You know, so, and it's amazing too, because, you know, you talk about environment, and I think sometimes we forget that different behavior intervention plans don't always, or I guess, let me take that back. Actually, the same intervention plans don't always work in different environments.
Correct.
Right. Correct.
And why, right. Why do you think that is?
Well, from my experience, right? I'm just going to use this word because it's been used before in my personal practice, not as a BCBA, but more so as a BT, but
okay.
Extinction, escape extinction, which, you know, in when I was a BT, I was told that I had to basically place the demand and keep it in place every 30 seconds. I was not allowed to modify the demand. I was not allowed to, like, that was an instruction from my supervisor at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Put that in a school setting.
Oh, yeah.
Not going to work, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so it kind of, at least from that experience,
yeah.
You know, my experience there, I could not do that in a school. You know, I could not personally tell a kid every 30 seconds, write your name. Like that's just not, at least from my experience, that is not how that would be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I have to 100% agree. But I also think I would like to add that it also depends on who is also implementing it, right? Luckily, you were a BT at the time who had that training. So yeah. Even if the school environment required for you to do that, you had the skills to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, my clients, you know, Abuela, who I love so dearly, will not understand anything like that I'm writing down, and no, she will not be doing it. So I think that's also a, you know, a factor that we also have to consider as well, is who is implementing it, who spends the most time, you know, with the client or the student, because that also will not only make and break your buy-in, right, with the family and those stakeholders, but it will make or break whether or not your behavior plan that you spent hours writing and individualizing and proofreading will be actually implemented.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, and I think it just goes to show you, you know, when it comes back to cultural humility, you almost have to take aside what you feel is the best, what you feel, not what the environment is, not what the client feels, what you feel maybe in that moment, it's probably not right. You know, yeah. Maybe you do need to modify it a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. And that could also include translation. I've spent countless dollars on translating documents because if I need that buy-in, or I need you to work on something at home that we're doing at school, if your primary language, you know, is Spanish, I'm going to get that translated for you. That way you feel comfortable and more inclined to, you know, implement those same strategies at home as well. And that makes a world of difference.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you right now, and this is going to sound really, really sad,
mm-hmm.
but this is my first. So I'm in a position where I currently work with a variety of non-English speaking families. I okay. work with a few clients that are Spanish speaking. I've worked with mm-hmm. some clients that are Amharic speaking, okay. you know, so I've worked with a variety. I'm now at the point where I've started to work with more and more types of families that speak different languages.
Yeah.
And it's kind of amazing because when I have, when I've done this in the past, like translation wasn't really something that was even like, not that it wasn't an option, mm-hmm. but it wasn't discussed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I feel like now that I look back, and I'm doing a little bit of self-reflection myself here, because, you know, we all have to do that. I think that even back then, like, I could have been a much more effective behavior analyst had I taken the time to truly try to at least help my families in that regard. Because I could easily write out, you know, a protocol in English. I could easily write something out that could be readable and easy to understand. But if my family doesn't understand because mm-hmm. I'm not writing in their native language,
yeah,
how am I going to expect the buy-in, you correct. Know?
Correct. And I also don't want you to be too hard on yourself or harp on that, because you yeah. did the best you could with the means that you had. And again, that education. But that's why I preach self-reflection all of the time, because we do make mistakes, or, you know, we do have, you know, practice with some ignorance sometimes. And yeah. I feel like I'm at a point in my career, I'm at a point in my life where the ignorance card just doesn't work anymore, right? Google is a thing. So if you do not have access to, you know, those peer-reviewed journals, right, through a university, there's also Google Scholar. You know, there are also so many different avenues. And I think this, not to gear off topic, but this is also the importance of networking as yeah. well. Right. I'm a PhD student, and I'm talking to everybody at all times, because someone has something or has access to something that I may need one day or may need help with one day. And I want people to do that for me too. Like, hey, Quintara, you know, I heard you on this podcast. You know, I want to follow you on Instagram. I may need some help with searching for some journal articles about this topic. Right. And then again, here I am, and I would love to assist with that, because again, the ignorance card, it just doesn't cut it anymore. We owe it to our ethics code. We owe it to our field. We owe it to our families, and we owe it to ourselves to really practice with a compassionate and multicultural stance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, just wow. You left me speechless. You're leaving me speechless.
I'm so passionate about this topic.
And I appreciate that so much. Like, you know, for me, like, it's so nice and refreshing to talk to you about this. And I think that, you know, when our listeners really dive in and listen to this, I hope that our listeners learn a lot. You know, I hope that they are, you know, they sort of like go into their practice and their, you know, whether that be their practice as an RBT or a BCBA or BCABA or whatever they are, or just being a human being.
Yeah.
I hope that they can take away some very powerful lessons. Cause I know, like, just based on our conversation tonight, I can tell you, like, I'm that much more motivated, you know, to go into my job and to really, like, and not just go into my job, but go into life with a different lens, you know?
Yeah, I'm so happy to hear that. I've had goosebumps like 3 times while having this conversation, just because, you know, it was so what is needed. And it's very rare that I get to, you know, geek out on this topic, and for a good purpose, for a good cause, like we discussed earlier. Sometimes I'm talking about it while providing feedback, because unfortunately many people just haven't heard of this topic, or other times I'm discussing it because it has something to do with my residency or my dissertation, right?
Yeah.
So to really discuss this and to inform others and to disseminate this topic, it definitely means so much. And I cannot thank you for the opportunity enough.
Oh my gosh. It is an honor to even like have you talk to me about this, you know, and I really am genuinely so excited for this episode in particular to launch yeah. for that reason, you know? So I am beyond thankful. And I want to go into our second code word of the evening. And that word is mystical. Like, this conversation has been mystical and amazing. Mystical. So that is spelled MYSTICAL, mystical. I do have one last question for you.
Of course.
You know, or well, actually I have a couple, but more yeah. than my main last questions. Yeah. So what resources or trainings would you say you recommend for parents and school personnel, and not only parents and school personnel, but, you know, people in general, RBTs, BCBAs, to better understand, or what do you recommend for them to better understand and support the implementation of behavior intervention plans within diverse cultural contexts, but also while promoting compassionate care?
Well, I'm so glad you asked me this question because I actually do have my own training live on my website currently co titled A Multicultural and Compassionate Approach to Creating Behavior Intervention Plans. Again, that is live on my website as a CEU. You could find that at www.qbconsulting111.com. I also authored two staff training manuals that also briefly explore these topics of compassion and cultural humility while working in ABA. We are actually in the process of creating courses to go along with these training manuals, and these courses are set to launch sometime before summer. So just keep your eye out for those. I'm super, super excited about that. But aside from my personal resources, I do recommend a book which has been the basis of my research lately because it is so. It covers absolutely everything. This book is called Multiculturalism and Diversity in Applied Behavior Analysis. It was edited by Brian Connors and Shanti Kapel. It's absolutely, it, this is the book that changed my view on ABA and multiculturalism and practicing and how I should be practicing, in ABA.
Oh my goodness. That is awesome. And I will be sure to make sure that I get on like a mailing list or something so that way I make sure that I see this.
Yes.
I want to dive into all the resources as much as humanly possible. So, Quintera, I am so happy that I got to do this interview again. Like I cannot express enough how happy I've been to be able to talk to you about this. This is such an important topic, and I'm so glad that we took the time to just talk about this in more detail, because this is a topic that needs to be discussed, and it needs to be ultimately practiced,
No,
So,
I agree.
I love it so much. And well, my last question to you is, where can our listeners find you?
Oh, that's a good one. Well, again, you could find me on my website, again, which is www.qbconsulting111.com. You could also find me on LinkedIn. You could just type in my name, Quintara Tucker, Q-U. Quintara, last name Tucker, and I should pop right up because I'm not sure how many Quintaras there are in the world. But you'll find me there. But I am also the face behind the very aesthetically pleasing Instagram page, the Mystical Analyst.
Love it. Love it. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for listening in on this amazing and important conversation. Be sure to submit your code words. That way you can get your free CEUs. And we look forward to hearing you and seeing you on the next episode. Thanks, guys. Bye.